Briggs.
And this is Leah Brown.
And the fellow across the table from us is Stanley Konjorski, the Director of International Studies at Slippery Rock University. This is an interview for our oral history collection on October 20th, 1993. We'd like to kind of launch this with the how did you get here question.
How did I get here to the university? So going on 26 years ago is when it all happened. Was fortunate enough to be at the right place at the right time. I was studying at the University of Buffalo with Doug Klinger and Rod Oberlin, who were here at the time on the coaching staff, and met them. And during that summer, a vacancy came became available on the football staff, and was fortunate enough to have an interview and were appointed to the position as assistant football coach and teaching in the then physical education department.
So that was 67 or?
No, 68. Came in 68. August of 68.
And helped launch the championship years.
Well, it was part of it.
We're going to kind of jump ahead to what you're doing now to make sure we get to that. How did the... I know that I was here for a long time, and we were getting some students from other countries kind of intermittently. How did that all evolve into what we have now?
I think it goes back to the early 70s with Don Megnan, who's professor of government and political science today, as we call the department. Don and I think several other interested faculty members on campus begin to see the need to internationalize the campus. And one of the first ways they looked at was to bring international students here in an organized fashion. Don Megnan was the first director of international programs at Slippery Rock. From, I can't give you the exact date in which Don did begin his duties. However, I will tell you that Don wrote a very extensive history of the origins of international studies at Slippery Rock, which he gave to me about 2 months ago, and I've turned that over to the archives. So there is Don's written record of the evolution. The numbers were initially small as far as international students coming here, and stayed that way until the mid-1980s. Internationalism on our campus was fragmented, as it still is, I must say, on most campuses in the country, unless you're at very large schools. And by fragmented, I mean the admissions people who really didn't want to do it, but because they were admissions, had to admit. Then you would find someone who was given some release time to be their advisor. Then there might be someone else who had an interest in trying to help Americans to go overseas to be, quote, study abroad. And that's kind of the way it was. Don kind of tried to juggle it all. And Don was the director through 1980 or 81, I forget, it shows loss of memory. But I was fortunate to be appointed in 1981, succeeding Don, when President Ebersol was the acting vice president for academic affairs. And with his appointment, there would begin to be, I think, some real support to internationalize the campus. He had no idea specifically what we needed to do, but other than the fact, he said, we must start. And we were then given a budget to, as any other group on campus, and then we saw some growth. We began to do some active recruiting of international students. The numbers rose. The exact figures I can't give you offhand, but they're in the archives of all our annual reports. Every one of our annual reports since 1981 has been placed in the archive. But we were dealing with 25, 30, 35 international students, and basically sending very, very few Slippery Rock students overseas. The overseas program basically consisted of sending students to an organization that all the state schools were a part of. It was called the PCIE, and they were basically summer programs in Salzburg, and then I think there was one in Oxford. And then when Dr. Ebersole was appointed president and began to search for his provost, he made the comment that that person will have international experience because we need to do more. And then the real commitment, I think, came in about 1985 to really move forward. We were given permission to bring in an outside consultant to review everything that we're doing, to give us some direction. We were able to convince the administration that it would be in the best interest not only of their goals to internationalize the campus, but also from a cost point of view, to take and centralize everything, bring everything under one roof, so to speak. And then, so therefore, in 1987, Pam Fergeau, who had been in the admissions office doing the international admissions, was brought into our office as a full-time employee, strictly to handle not only the international admissions, but she is still the international student advisor, which makes us very unique in the state system because she is the only full-time international student advisor in the state system. With that, there also came a commitment to increase the number of American students to study overseas, and then also to take and provide opportunities for faculty to study overseas. And those are our three major objectives of the International Studies program: to bring international students here, to send Americans overseas, and to send our faculty overseas and bring international faculty here. And Dr. Faust, the provost, current provost, has extensive background in international studies, and so therefore that, I think, was another major commitment, and a real tremendous growth has taken place since his appointment. He has been extremely supportive, to a point where I think if you look at the numbers, today we have 236 international students from 68 different countries studying at Slippery Rock. The goal here is not to have numbers. The goal is cultural diversity. And we really would like 100 countries represented. So we're searching, working very hard to diversify. And I think if you look at schools across the country, 68 nations represented is a large number. Many schools have far more students, but you may find they may be 100 from one country. And we've opted not to go that route. We've opted for the diversity. We're right up front with the students. We tell them they're here for two basic reasons. The second reason is to obtain a good education. The first reason we want them here is to educate us. And that is why the international students have to live their first year in a residence hall. They have to have an American roommate. And they are not all in one residence hall as some schools do. It would be much more convenient for us from a logistical or administrative point if we put everybody in one residence hall. But then they're only educating themselves. And our goal is to have them educate the American students. And Pam has done an excellent job of recruiting and working with those students. We have an extremely low attrition rate. If we have two students a year who transfer out of here, and it's usually due to program that they have to transfer. As far as the internet Americans going overseas, currently we have moved from those one or two summer programs in the early 80s to today we have 28 different programs in 17 countries. And we are currently exploring about three more programs. If we can finalize the last three programs, we will have just about every major on the campus covered. So any student at Slippery Rock can study overseas in his or her discipline. If all goes as we think it will for this current academic year, 93-94, we will have close to 300 American students studying overseas. Whereas if you go back to about 82 or so, I think there was something like 17 who studied overseas. So there's been a real commitment to that end.
By studying overseas, you mean for a semester? You don't mean for these 3 weeks, summer?
It means everything, Leah. For example, we still have the summer programs. We run our own today. We don't work with a consortium. We will send students in the summer, really anywhere a faculty member wants to develop a program. We traditionally still go to Dublin, Ireland, and to Edinburgh, Scotland, to Salzburg, Austria, and to Russia, as Professor Tichy has done for the last almost 20 years. If a faculty member comes in and says, I would like to take a group somewhere, as Professor Nichols did in the summer of 93, to Turkey. I worked with him, put together a program, and he took 21 people to Turkey for almost 3 weeks. We have a faculty member right now who would like to take a group of students to Pakistan this summer. If we can work it out, we'll work it for so that it can happen. The other programs we have in length in the summer, we send business interns to the UK. And these are very unique programs in that the students are paid to work for multinational corporations. And they earn anywhere from 9 to 12 hours of academic credit. This has become an extremely successful program in that it's very competitive. For the 8 to 10 positions that we have, we'll have 50 applicants. And the student doesn't even apply unless they're a three-point student. So we have the problem of selection. And Professor Phil Kennedy in accounting coordinates that program for us and supervises it. We also have an 8-week student teaching program two of them, in fact. In the fall, we will send students to Dublin, Ireland, where they will teach in Irish public schools and live with Irish host families. So they're not only having a very unique educational experience, but a truly unique cultural experience. In the spring, we will send our student teachers to Mexico City. There they teach at the American International School. And it truly is an international school because 40% of the students are American, 50% are Mexican, and the other 10% are made up of students from around the world. So our students get a very unique experience in Mexico. We also have some programs we're working on for the non-traditional student. We now will send early childhood majors to Mexico City for 3 weeks in May to do an early childhood practicum. Many of these people are married with family, and to go overseas for 8 weeks or a semester is obviously impossible. But we have found that they're very receptive for 3 weeks in Mexico. And it's an incredible early childhood center that we're associated with. And so they have a very, very unique experience. Starting in 95, we were going in 94, but 95 now, we will do a two-week business seminar in London for business majors, which is going to allow students to interface with CEOs of multinational corporations. And then we have the traditional semester in academic year programs. So what we try to provide is a variety. Another new program, a short term, Dr. John Craig, who's head of the honors program, we've worked with him, and this March during our spring break, will be the first group, but we hope to make this an annual, he will take honors students for 2 weeks to non-Western European cultures. We're going to start this this March. We're going to Slovakia to expose those gifted students, those honor students, to Eastern Europe. We hope to follow that up by taking the group to Turkey. So we're trying to do some different, unique kind of programming for our students. A real major thrust for us has been to move from the traditional base of overseas study for Americans, which was Western Europe, to move out of Western Europe. That doesn't mean we're going to forget Western Europe. I mean, it's still very popular and will always continue to be, but we're trying to move more into Eastern Europe. We now have students studying in Slovakia, Hungary, Bulgaria, and this February, three will leave for Russia. We also are working to send more of our students to the Orient. We now have programs, exchange programs, in Japan, in China, in Korea. And also, we now teach those languages, which I think is a real compliment to Slippery Rock, because not many schools in the United States teach Korean, Chinese, and Japanese. Everybody's trying to get on the bandwagon for Japanese. We've been teaching Japanese since 87, but we also, as I said, teach Chinese and Korean. The University of Pittsburgh, for example, does not teach Korean. You can't take Korean at the University of Pittsburgh. And so not only are we having students enrolled in those courses here at Slippery Rock, we're actually sending students to those countries for a semester or a year. Numbers are small. I think this year we'll probably have 12 students, but I would dare say that's 12 more than most schools in the United States have going to that part of the world. So we really have tried to cover the globe for overseas study opportunities. And then for faculty, we now have opportunities galore for faculty. In fact, last academic year, 61 faculty were supported in some way to go overseas, whether they represented us on an exchange program, whether they supervised student teachers or interns, taught a summer course, presented papers at conferences, or were sent overseas to help develop a new program. Because we honestly believe that the program will only survive if there is faculty involvement. And so therefore, I rarely put a program together. I will work with a faculty or a department to put it together, because they're the ones that have to sell it. They're the ones that have to indicate to their students that this is what you should be doing for your career goals. And we pay for it. We send at our expense when we send these faculty. And that has become the faculty are really buying into it, not only obviously for themselves, so they have an opportunity to internationalize themselves and their discipline, but they have been extremely supportive of encouraging our students to move out and see that there's more to the world than Western Pennsylvania.
How did it happen that you came into international studies in the first place?
I was very fortunate in 1976 to have been granted a sabbatical. And at my academic appointment was and still is in Allied Health Department. And I was teaching a course in human sexuality and was able to be granted a sabbatical to study the K-12 human sexuality program in Stockholm, Sweden. And I was at the University of Stockholm. I guess I got the international bug at that time. And then when Don Megnan decided that he wanted to do other things, as I said, I happened to be in the right place at the right time again.
And one of your goals is to have these international students educate the American students. Have you had some feedback from the American students?
I think all kinds of feedback. Most of it obviously is indirect. Mm-hmm. For example, a young lady came in yesterday and said she needed some help because she wants to take her American roommate to Brazil because she's Brazilian for Christmas. They're going home. We see all kinds of friendships. Also yesterday, we have one of the first group of black South Africans here. We're in a program this was initiated by Harvard and Brown University, and we have two South Africans here this year. The program representatives came in from New York yesterday and were talking to the students, and the young lady that is here, the undergraduate student, was telling about her experiences going home already with her roommate and going out to dinner in Pittsburgh with her parents and these kinds of things. So that's education. Maybe it's not in the formal sense, but what we see are friendships that have developed, marriages that have taken place. We see Americans coming into the office and saying, I want to study overseas. And one of the reasons we asked why, I've gotten to know so-and-so. And I'm beginning to see that there is more to life than Western Pennsylvania. And I think it's going to help me in the job market if I have an overseas experience. And then we see increased numbers of Americans becoming involved in the Internations Club. It's not the sole ownership of the international students. They're becoming involved. So yeah, we see the educational process. I think faculty could address that maybe even better. simply because if you have somebody from South Africa in one of your political science classes, wow, what firsthand knowledge that they can bring forth into a discussion that would never have taken place. I'll never forget the Afghan freedom fighters that we had here on a special program. And both have completed their degrees and gone back. And one is coming back for his master's in January. But a faculty member calling and saying, what an incredible class we just had because of these two young men telling about what it's like to be a Mahadeen. And it, where you can't learn that out of a textbook. And so not only was it one-on-one education, those young men educated all those students in those classes that they interacted with. And I think we see an awful lot of that. It must be working simply because faculty now call us and say, if you have an international student, put them in my class. Don't even fill out the drop an ad card. If the class is closed, override the computer. We have a number of faculty who literally call Pam and say, when you're scheduling, put those kids in my class because of what they add to the class.
I know they were great in speech classes because generally we don't tie people to topics. And when you get an international student, then they are the topic.
Yeah.
You know, their country and their customs. And of course, if you're doing discussions on healthcare, they can bring a lot to healthcare, you know.
Sure can. Mm-hmm.
They're particularly good in classes because they're very good students. They're articulate. They're bright. They're outgoing. Or they wouldn't have come here in the place.
Sure. You think of somebody who... We all know what it's like to see the new freshman coming in from Pittsburgh in a daze, coming 60 miles away and going away from home for the first time. Imagine the amount of maturity that has to be there and self-confidence and independence to pick up and come halfway or three-quarters of the way around the world to Western Pennsylvania.
Then they have to learn our language, not just English. I mean, Western Pennsylvania.
That's very, very true. That's very, very true. Yes.
Although they do come, or the ones I've encountered, do come with some English, isn't that?
We require, yes. Okay. They must take what is known as a test of English language proficiency before they come. And we use a minimum score of 500. And we have found that students who have a score of 500 can survive in the academic classroom. They struggle, many of them, particularly those coming from the Orient, will struggle the first semester. As you mentioned, you know, learning Western Pennsylvania English, okay, and all the idioms and all the slang that is thrown about. But because of their work ethic, this is a common scenario. About the third, fourth week of class, typically three or four professors will call and say, boy, I'm really worried about so-and-so from Japan or from wherever. I just think the language is just not coming. The barrier's there. They're just struggling. And so, you know, we try working with the student. And we tell the professor that I pretty much can guarantee you that by the end of the semester you will see a changed person. And more often than not, what happens, the phone call comes back and said, this is our star. And it's, a lot of it is due to that work ethic. They will work so hard to improve that English. And again, I think that's a very positive comment about commentary about the faculty. They care. I mean, it could just easily write that student off, but they take the time to call the office and say, I'm worried about so-and-so. And that's where I think it's made our job so easy because the faculty do get involved, the faculty do care.
So you schedule, you and Pam schedule these students?
On only the first. Only there are, on their, when they come here and they say that they're going to be a computer science major, we will try to get them maybe one, maximum of two courses in their major. And then we, you know, if they're now in liberal studies, we work in those kinds of courses. And then from the second semester on, they go into the mainstream. They are into the department and have their own academic advisor. They're part of the system. They're a part of the system. That's also a lot of, it isn't fun when we're doing it, but we, after it's all over, we can laugh. These students come and they look at their schedule. But I'm a biology major and you only have me in one biology class. Why am I taking a speech class? Why am I taking an art class? I am not an art major. I am a biology major. And so that's part of the educational process to show what we mean by we want the well-rounded individual. We don't want just somebody who knows how to punch the keys on the computer. We want you to be able to discuss art. We want you to be able to discuss music. We want you to be able to get in front of a crowd and make your presentation about computers. Computer science, no liberal arts.
They're kind of trade schools then, or?
Oh, these are universities, yeah. So this is university level. And we get a very unique
student. Just don't do a liberal arts.
No, program. No. They figure that should have been done on the secondary school level. That's what they tell us. So they're very interesting people. We get some incredibly interesting people.
It wasn't always that way. I remember when the Iraqi students came 15 years ago.
Thank God I was not involved with those Iraqi. problem.
I had them all in class.
Uh-huh.
And I also was a thesis advisor
mm-hmm.
on a phys ed.
Yes.
With and we had wild times, believe me.
Well, that was all part of this fragmentation.
Yeah, Ray Owens was, yeah. But, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this is now, you know, Pam scrutinizes every one of those. That's why we have the TOEFL scores to protect faculty from that. I mean, otherwise an inordinate amount of time is put into two or three students that shouldn't be.
We had some interesting experiences here in the library because, of course, a lot of them like to work in the library. But with those Iraqi students, the culture really got in the way. They will not take orders from a woman.
Oh.
So that even the simplest direction of how you perform some duty had to be done by a man. We learned a lot,
mm-hmm.
and we didn't change their behavior a whole lot, but I suppose eventually
mm-hmm.
it worked out.
Yep. Yeah, we still run into some of that. There's a student here right now from the Middle East who's very polite, but let it be known right on the first encounter that he cannot shake Pam's hand because she's a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Very polite, does it, you know, very nice, but he says that. My culture.
And we can accommodate that.
Oh, by all means, yeah. Sure. We sure don't want the international students to come here to become Americanized. Unfortunately, some do. But no, we don't want them to become Americanized.
Do a lot of them do jobs on the campus?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, again, we're very fortunate in that the administration, they can legally work on campus. There's no problem with that immigration-wise. But obviously you have to have an administration that says they can work. Now, we don't find them jobs. They're on their own, just as the student from Pittsburgh has to find his or her own job. I think their overall record is such that, again, employers on campus want them. They're here for weekends. They're not going to go home. They're dependable. you know they're going to be here on the weekend or 10 o'clock in the computer lab. So they do fine jobs.
Are they from particular economic groups from their countries? Or
does runs that... the gamut. We have diplomatic children here. We have ambassadors' children. We have students who are here who are incredibly poor, and how they survive is beyond me, but they do. We had a young lady who supposedly was to have support, an African woman, and then once she got here, her sponsor just walked away. And to show you the work ethic, she went this past summer to Alaska and worked on those fishing boats out in the Bering Straits, and just, you know, 12, 14 hours a day in order to be able to come back here to finish her degree. I mean, some of the things that some of these students do in order to stay. So we have the whole gamut. We really do. Some are well off, and we have those that you just wonder if they're eating.
Was her story in the rocket?
No, she won't.
She didn't make the rocket.
No, she doesn't want it. She's just that type of a person that is very, very quiet about it, and is just an incredible woman.
How about their acceptance in the Slippery Rock
community?
Community. I remember stories about a student who was trying to get a job in the supermarket, and others were hired, and he was not, and it was not pleasant.
Slippery Rock is probably no different than any other community. We have discrimination. We're not that naive. One of the very first things we tell them is that what won't be tolerated on this campus, we tell them for their own little personal problems, Pam and I can't solve them. They're human beings. They have to learn to solve many of their own little personal problems. But we expect and demand that if in any way, shape, or form they think that they have been discriminated against because of their color, because of their religion, or from the country that they're from, we want to know about that immediately, and we will pursue it to the utmost. And we do get students to come in, and we pursue it. You know, if they're having trouble with a boyfriend or girlfriend, well, sorry, I can't help you get a date. But on those matters, we're very concerned about. We've had some instances where students have been ripped off by landlords. And so we'll step in. But I really think, on the whole, we're seeing an improvement in that, simply because we have been able to work the last 2 years to improve the weakest part of our program, and that has been community outreach. We now have host families, which we never have had before. I shouldn't say that. We've always had host families here that Pam and I never knew about, where this faculty member, this secretary, this person from maintenance has taken an international student into their home that we still don't know about, and that's fine. We don't have to know about those things. But now we've been able to organize a more formal host family. And we work with one of the churches here in town and also one in Butler. And both of these groups are not trying to spread their religion. They just love to take these students into their homes and provide them with an exposure to America. So with that, I think we're seeing fewer problems. And another very conscious decision that was made here was not to bring in 50, 60 students from one country, because we are a small town. And human beings being what they are, the students would take and congregate. They would form little pockets within the community, which in turn would have the community going at them, as happens in other institutions. So we deliberately try to keep the number around 10, 12 from a country, so that we don't have these kinds of problems that you're alluding to. But I think the community, there's been so much, and everything the university has been doing the last 3 or 4 years to tell the community to, and by the community I mean more than just Slippery Rock, that this is an international institution. All our publications that go out of here today emphasize that fact. Homecoming last week was, or 2 weeks ago, the theme was international. So I think it's becoming a part of the community that you will see people dress differently. You will see and hear accents, but those are very positive aspects for a community. We don't see as much as we did 3 or 4 years ago. And again, I think that's a positive commentary on the community. There will always be discrimination. We'll never get rid of that.
And Rotary, of course, has been bringing international kids in here for,
to the high school.
30 years?
They have a very long
yes.
history. So the public school has had students. And also I have to say the public school has been, the system has been very, very good to us in that when we bring our international faculty here, some come with family. And their children enroll in the Slippery Rock School District. And some of those children come here without one word of English. And the school system has been very supportive. And they go home, those young children, that's no better time to learn a language, fluent in English. Our goal here at Slippery Rock is to have 10% of the Slippery Rock students every year overseas. That's what we'd like to have. And we're doing, I think, some unique things. Again, that's because the administration is allowing it. Every student, Slippery Rock student who goes overseas, not only can use every single penny of their financial aid that the university grants, but we now are paying part of their airfare to go overseas. So for Europe this year, we're paying $200. I think next year that will go up to between $250 and $300. Any student who goes to the Orient today, we're paying $500, and we hope to increase that to $700. Also, the university has made a tremendous commitment in its first capital campaign. There are three goals in the capital campaign, and one of the goals is to raise approximately $400,000 to $500,000 in an endowment fund to support our students to go overseas, which puts us in a truly unique position throughout the United States. When I tell people that this institution, this size, a state school, they're just awed that this commitment has been made by Slippery Rock to develop that kind of resource, that kind of funding. So it makes Pam's and my job very easy.
Do we do a site visitation? There's an exchange visitation that takes place in almost all of those connections, or at least the major connections where we're going to be teaching there. And
Oh, sure. As I said, for example, when we're going to try to do something new, and it is totally centered in on one discipline, a faculty member will go there. For example, Professor Didasio, we sent her to France to make sure that is what the French faculty wanted for their students to study in France. And so she spent a week at that site. We also have seen to it that the various deans have gone to look at a site if it pertains to their area. So you know, we have that administrative support not only from the president and provost, but the deans also. For example, in Russia, last November, or excuse me, December, Dean Ann Griffiths, Dr. Larry Patrick in Sustainable Systems, and myself, we spent 9 days in Russia because that program will be for sustainable systems, environmental education. And as an outgrowth of that, we see that there's a strong potential for biology. So they saw what is there to offer. I go basically not to become 100% knowledgeable of the academics. I have to be aware of all the logistics because it's me who parents call, want to know if there's heat in the room, can they take 3 showers a day, you know, those kinds of logistical things that Americans want to know. So I go looking for that kind of information. But then when it comes to the academic, there will be a faculty member there. We're going to send Jerry Chmielewski out of biology back to Russia next March because he thinks there's incredible opportunities for certain biology students. So every one of those sites have been visited.
Is Russ Whaley still on our faculty?
No, Russell is gone. Russell did spend quite a bit of time in Saudi Arabia.
Oh, yes, I know.
Dodging the Scud missiles when they were incoming because he was there at that time. No, he's retired. He's out in either Washington or Oregon now, I understand.
Well, I just wondered because he came back and then he'd go back.
Oh, yes.
And,
he became
a kind of a permanent fixture. And he was there several years?
Oh, gee, I think at least three.
Yeah, at least
in
three.
In Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
So we're in real exciting times as far as international. We have, this past 2 weeks, we've had Robert Morris and a contingent of faculty and administrators up. We've had Clarion come in. A school from Wisconsin wants to come in to see what we're doing. And the buzzword in higher education today is international. But very, very few schools are putting their resources into it like this institution has committed.
Lock Haven did some early stuff with Poland.
Lock Haven still has a very strong program. IUP had a very strong program. In fact, it was on a dean's level, but they have knocked it back considerably. They've downsized, I guess is the word, because of financial constraints.
Shall we back up to one of your previous incarnations?
Yeah. But are you still teaching?
I teach one class. I teach the death and dying course.
Oh,
it's
yes.
By choice.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So just one class.
So you miss your 12-hour, you made the transition okay.
Oh, yes. Yeah. But I still want to teach. That's why
sure.
I keep the one class.
Well, you had such a good reputation, you know. I was here a long time, and I heard really good things.
Thank you.
I'm very pleased to say that, because if you're on a campus for 20 years or so, and you never hear anything about your colleagues, then it's bothersome to have your students and your advisees talk about other faculty in a positive sense, rather than the complaints, you know, is really a nice thing. But your teaching style what is your teaching style? Can you describe it? I know that's a weird question.
I don't know.
But I've always been a little bit curious about when I hear good things about other teachers, I say, gee, wonder how they do that.
I really don't know, other than the fact that I get bored listening to myself, so I try to pull out a lot of things from the students and have them involved as much as possible. And fortunately, particularly the Death and Dying course is a course that everybody's had experience with. And so therefore, there can be a lot of personal experiences that we all can learn from.
Of really worthwhile information.
Oh, yeah. Yes, sure, sure.
Because that's one of the problems with using groups in lots of courses, is you get a lot of chaff and very little wheat.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And but if you have survived a very serious illness, and you can relate what your feelings are and some of the things that will happen to you, I can learn from that. So in the same thing with grief, if you've lost a significant person in your life, and these were the circumstances, inevitably there's somebody in the class who's saying, oh, it's the same way I felt, or I wish I would have tried that. So yeah, there's a lot of true learning. Not textbook many times, but human to human.
Are we still learning more about hospices?
Oh, hospices are becoming more and more prevalent. I think we have a very good one here in western Pennsylvania, particularly in Butler County. It's not a building. It's not a freestanding. It's a program. It's a program. And the Hospice Visiting Nurses Association has. We have some excellent people that can really assist families.
Sounds as if the students get a little bit of therapy along with the learning in your class.
Yeah, I never thought of it that way, but I would think probably some. Uh-huh. Because, you know, we go around, and the students are very open, surprisingly. From, you know, a loved one now currently dying to... I've attempted suicide to, you know, you name it. So there's a lot of openness, and they share those feelings, which I think are therapy. They do a lot of writing. We try to have them do a lot of writing about what they want, even to a point where we have them write to the deceased and pouring out those feelings. It's some incredible things. Tell a student, you know, give an assignment, you say, because a typical student, how many pages, you know, that. So if you say two, you'd be amazed at some of the things. I've got 20 pages from a student one time who just had to pour out those feelings. And I would like to think, I guess, that is therapy for that particular person. And obviously that's not shared with the rest of the class. That's that person's. So it's a very enjoyable class. Most people don't think death is enjoyable, but to teach it is.
Is the human sexuality course still being taught?
Oh, yes, yeah, sure, yes. In the department, yeah.
Because I didn't,
yes.
You know, for years, you were the sole teacher of that course, of course,
yeah,
sometimes.
Yeah, I think so.
Yes,
yeah,
I think so.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes when there's only one teacher who develops the course, like death and dying, uh-huh. or human sexuality, if they move on to other arenas, mm-hmm. You lose the course, some programs, like our public relations program. We had Pam Shingler, when Pam moved on, that thing went into serious decline.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. No, it's still offered in the department. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So those were your two favorite courses, is that you taught?
Yes. They really were. Uh-huh.
Well, you made a difference, and still are making a difference.
Well, you know, one of the things about the human sexuality course, I heard a lot about it from my students, and it was always serious stuff. Nobody was poking fun at the course, because it's the kind of course where, you know, you could have a lot of silly season.
Oh, sure you could.
But it wasn't.
Tried not to have it. I mean, with anything, even with death, there's humor. But I think there's a difference between humor and just outright flippant types of things.
Tasteless stuff.
Tasteless, that's a better word.
So with all of this activity, your teaching and your international program, does that leave you any time for anything athletic, Stan?
No more. I'm a couch potato in that respect. No, Let me see. Gee, it's going. This is the 10th year I've been out of coaching. I coached here for 15, and then this will be the 10th year. It's hard to believe that it's been 10 years since I stopped coaching. No regrets. No regrets from coaching, and no regrets from leaving. It was time. And again, that's been the, for me personally, been the beauty of Slippery Rock. I've been able to change jobs and not move. And as we all know, we go through various job changes in our life, and we have to uproot most of the time. But I've been fortunate to really have three job changes at Slippery Rock. Came primarily, you know, as a coach. I did have to teach, but I was here in my mind to coach, as I think most young coaches are at the time. And was Slippery Rock enabled me to see that there's more to athletics than athletics. There is an educational component, and I was able to develop a course on human sexuality, a course on death and dying. It allowed me to pursue academic interests, and then it gave me an opportunity to be involved as I am today with the International. So there's been a very, very, for me, it's been a very, very positive 25 years.
I was always impressed that early when I came here, 71, 72, 73, with the fact that the coaches were faculty members and that they held faculty rank. I understand that's no longer, or that's been...
Partially.
Yes.
Partially.
Yeah, they've eaten into that process.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, I think it has it's a very, very positive because for several reasons. One, it allowed us to interact with faculty. Too many times coaches are an entity unto themselves, almost not a part of the university. We were on the same university committees as someone from chemistry or wherever they were housed. So we interacted with faculty. It also made us understand the role and the pressures of being a student because we had to go in front of a class also. We had to prepare. So therefore, we couldn't make undue demands on a student's time, and they're still students. That's what they're here for, is their degree. They're not here to play football, in my case. They're here to get a degree and play some football on the side. And so I think it's the ideal combination. We moved away from that, obviously, somewhat, but the current head coach has a PhD and still teaches 6 hours. And one of his assistants is in physical education. The rest of his help is full-time coaching. But yet, if you move to some of our other state system schools, those staffs are 100% non-faculty. They are there for football or basketball exclusively.
And not long ago, we were 100% faculty.
Faculty.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What's your feeling about that change? Have you seen any results?
Yeah, I think the positive part of it, as far as staying, is that it keeps you in perspective. It keeps your program in perspective. The downside of that is, though, you're competing against people who don't have that philosophy, and it makes it very difficult. And you don't win on the collegiate level without recruiting. But if you are teaching 3 days a week and your competitor doesn't teach at all, your competitor is on the road 5 days a week, and if you're lucky, you make 2 days. So they're seeing and really recruiting far more extensively than you're able to. So that's the downside that you just don't have the opportunity, from what I hear from the coaches, to contact the players that you need.
What about the job security?
Oh, well, obviously that's the greatest thing there is. I mean, if you are here with faculty rank, as myself, I'm no longer in football, but I'm still here. Whereas if you are strictly here as a coach, it's all dependent upon the left-hand column, and that's wins. It's the number of your tenure is associated directly to the left-hand column, and that's the W's. Non-tenure status comes from the right-hand column, and that's the losses.
In the, let's see, we won state championships 72, 3, 4,
I
7?
Think so. Somewhere.
Yeah. Anyhow, there were, out of 6 years, we won 5 or 4 out of 5. Was there a special reason why we were that good at that time?
Yeah, I think I've mentioned this to Coach Mihalik just recently. Coaches are always looking for more resources, more talent, etc. And in the resource category, apparently Slippery Rock is not as high as the schools we compete against. And I said, George, you know, that's not the other school's fault. I says, it's our fault. And he says, yeah, I know it is. I said, yeah, but I don't think you understand the real reason. We were one of the first back in those early 70s to really actively recruit. It used to be in this state system who came play. Minor recruiting, nothing really extensive, organized. But with Coach DeSpirito, with his coming, we was a very, very rigorous recruitment program, and also working to secure funds to support the athlete to come here. I laugh at the amount of money compared to what is out there today, but it's all relative to when you were. So we were one of the first to start going out and working and to develop the N.K. Thompson Scholarship Fund, to start giving very small amounts of money. I think it was $500. And $500 today won't buy you a manager, let alone a quarterback. But we had the support of the administration at the time, Dr. Wattrell. He saw the positive image that a winning athletic program can have on the institution. He enabled us to recruit. We had our schedules set so that we could have at least 2 days a week off to go on the road. Prior to that, if you recall, I don't know when you came, Joe, but when I came, we taught 6 days a week. We had Saturday classes here. You had Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, and had a game Saturday afternoon. I'll never forget that. I think it was at least 2 years before that. Got rid of the Saturday classes.
So the road trips were really tricky.
Oh, they were really tricky. And when Dr. Wattrell came, we had Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and therefore could go on the road Tuesdays and Thursdays and contact young men to come here. And so that was a commitment by Dr. Wattrell to have a team. Nothing ever happens without a commitment. I don't care what it is.
Well, you got to have, and of course, that was, those were just 5 days.
One of the first questions people always ask you when you quit coaching, how does it feel? And your standard comment you'll hear from coach after coach, I never realized Sunday and Monday were so nice. Because those 2 days are usually your days that you were here till midnight.
You got to go with your kids.
You were here till all day Sunday till midnight and all day Monday till midnight. Those are very long days. And then your weekend travel if you're away. But it's you never realized Sunday and Monday existed.
You were talking about Bob DeSpirito as a major. Was he a major influence in your career?
Oh, I wouldn't be where I am today without Bob. I'm very indebted to the man, simply because he allowed you, one, if you're looking at it straight from an athletic point of view, he allowed you to coach, and he had a way of handling his staff that made you want to work for Bob, because Bob shared. Unlike some coaches who only know the word I, Bob never dealt
in the word I, except when there was a problem, and then Bob assumed that responsibility. And he answered for it. And anything else, though, was we or you. And he also allowed us to develop those academic pursuits. I mean, I could never have gone on sabbatical, unheard of a coach going on sabbatical, to develop not my football background, but to be able to do something academically. And so he allowed us to be not only creative, to do what we wanted to think we needed to do to win, but he allowed us to pursue other avenues. Bob does not like to talk football 24 hours a day. Bob likes to talk about art. He likes music. He loves to plant a garden. He likes to make his Goomba tomato sauce. You know, the other things in life. And he allowed us to do those kinds of things. So, and when, you know, it was time to move on, Bob was also one of the more supportive people. So, no, he's, I think it's, I many times I kid him also, you're the blame for all the problems around here, coach, because you're the one who brought this idea of winning and doing things the way it was. It's been around here for the last 15, 20 years. That never happened, apparently, till you came.
There were always, when I came here, there were always these wonderful stories about Albert Wattrell.
Uh-huh.
And they called him coach also.
Oh, yes, he was.
And the kind of strange, mistaken notion that he was calling plays. You know, the story got out, the story was totally out of hand. But it was a funny story. And Bob has, of course, marvelous recollections.
Oh,
and he
yeah.
sees Albert Wattrell when they come through town.
Uh-huh.
They're very much
sure.
in touch, and they stay with Bob and uh-huh. so forth. But he would talk about his mail, and he would talk about the Albert and the New Jersey and New York papers. Were you familiar with
all
that?
Oh, yes, I'm familiar with the 12 o'clock phone calls. I'm just reading the New York paper here, and there's about three or four kids, and you know, Al would call you and discuss them. He'd come down to practice, and he was quite an athlete at Syracuse. And I'll never forget one time, we were having difficulty. The poor kid couldn't make the deep snap on a punt team. He couldn't snap that ball back to save his life. Wattrell took his tie off and took his suit coat off and showed him how to snap that ball because he was a center. So, yeah, that was support. He really, he did. He allowed us, as I said, to recruit. He allowed us to start having some wherewithal to support that athlete. And I think if you go back and look at those graduation rates, you can honestly see that those were student athletes. We had some fantastic kids come out of here. Strong academics are doing extremely well today. So they were definitely student athletes. I think the whole time that is involved with it, only two students that I recruited didn't finish their degree. A lot of the students I recruited quit football. You know, they decided not to play football for 4 years. But as far as the student playing his 4 years of football, and not getting a degree, only two. And I think that was very, very typical of all of those recruits with Bob Espiro. Bob saved so many kids. I mean literally saved them, not just academically. And by saving, I don't mean where he knocked on the door of the professor and said, you changed that grade, because that's not Bob. But I meant working with that young man to point out to him that there is something out there more than football in life. Saving kids who had personal problems that some of us on the staff would shake our head at. Coach, why are you doing this? Why are you taking the time? And those kids are doing well today. I think most people would have thrown that young man on the trash heap. And not coach, he could see something deep down in there. He saved many a kid.
Coaches and athletes have a kind of a very special relationship. It's
yeah.
very different
oh, yeah.
From other
teacher-student kinds of things, which lends itself to a kind of camaraderie.
Oh, sure.
Where, and a kind of a hero worship in some cases, in a case like Bob and the players, or you and the players, where you could get things out of them that nobody else could get, you know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a faculty member sees somebody 3 days a week for 50 minutes.
Yeah, that is not to say that faculty
That's right.
didn't do the same
That's
thing.
That's right.
But you did it on a...
When you're with a young man for hours, and, you know, you're dealing with not only his physical abilities, but all the emotional and psychological things that are going on in that young man's life that are impacting on his ability to perform, you see people in a totally different light.
Did we have a lot of injuries? I know there were always some injuries, but we didn't have a lot of anything really terrible happening to our
No. athlete. Fortunately, you know, we've never had paralysis and some of those life-threatening. Every coach thinks they have more than their share of injuries, you know, the knees and the shoulders and the broken bones. But no, we were very, very fortunate never to have a life-threatening. Again, I think part of that was a reflection on the way coach ran the program. We were not here to feather our cap so we could move on to the Notre Dames and the Pitts and the Penn States. So we weren't trying to build a reputation on the back of the student. And so therefore the student was not abused.
Fundamentally, you just didn't hire people like that.
No, Coach Wood.
Your coach, yeah. He, I mean, if they were hot dogs and they were transients, he didn't hire transients.
He didn't. I mean, I remember afterwards being here, sitting in and listening to some interviews. And you could just see Coach wasn't going to hire that person because didn't fit in. Didn't fit in. Only wanted to win.
So injuries are more likely to happen when the students are just overworked.
And you know what's happened today in the NCAA, I think, again, I don't keep up with it, but there are limitations on the amount of practice time you can have. And that's what we've always had. We had one meeting.
Way before your time.
We had one meeting a week at night for the kids. Mm-hmm. We take them for an hour on Monday night. But we worked the other nights, but not students. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you would go to some of the big programs, it was 7 days a week, 365 days a year. I mean, it was just, they owned you. And there was no ever ownership here. And if a student said that, you know, and we, you don't like it, but when a student had a 4 o'clock lab, didn't get out until 5:30. That student didn't come to practice that day, as I mean, the chemistry department isn't going to schedule their lab at your convenience, and so they went to the chemistry lab or whatever lab it happened to be. And, so the kids weren't tired. They worked hard, but we didn't own them, and I think that's a real, real big difference. There's no ownership, even with today. I think with George having financial resources to give to a kid, there's no ownership here yet. George Mihalik doesn't believe in that either because he played under coach. And so I think you see an awful lot of that philosophy.
What other great people on this campus can you tell us about? Or maybe not so great, you know. But people who have impacted your life.
Well, I think the people that originally came with in the in the Allied Health, as then it was Health Education and Health Science, and now Allied Health, were some incredibly supportive people, because the department had to pick up some of the workload for people like myself who were coaching. We couldn't be in all the committees and, you know, those kinds of things we missed. People like Joyce Murray, who Joycey would give, Ken Lowry. I mean, they understood and they saw the value of athletics, and it's real true perspective. And so they supported you and allowed you to coach and encouraged you to coach. And I don't know if that would happen in a lot of departments, because other people would have to pick up some of that load. And it's an inevitable
burden.
It really is. And so, you know, those kinds of people have been very, very supportive. I've also had a very, very good relationship with Ann Griffith on an administrative point of view. She's been very, very supportive of things, when, you know, from when she was in the School of Education and now as Dean of Human Services. And the one person that I'll never forget, and he made me really see that Slippery Rock is a place in which learning does take place, because I've always respected him as being an intelligent man, was Bob McCoskey. Bob, you know, the philosopher. I barely can spell philosophy, let alone know what it stands for. But I remember him telling about some incidents of students and also who have gone here and who moved on and have done extremely well. Because he says, you know what? We use the same textbook as Harvard does. And we have produced some darn good kids, as he would say. Sometimes in a little different language, he would say it. But, we have some good kids coming out of here. And learning takes place here, because this is a teaching institution. And I think with teaching comes what the administration today, I think, constantly is telling people, comes caring. I really do. I think if you are a teacher, there's a caring aspect into it. And therefore, you take students and you really prepare them. And they can go on to grad school. And I'll give an example of that, an incredible example of it. An international student from Sweden came here, majored in chemistry, and was determined to go to MIT in an area called chemical oceanography. And, you know, he applied, and it's an interview process and everything. And he came back and he says, you know, when I applied, they said, in a way, forget about it. You're coming from Slippery Rock. How are you ever going to get into a program of chemical oceanography here at MIT? Two people that year were selected from the world, not the United States, from the world to enter that program. And one of them was a Slippery Rock student from Sweden. Why? Because he says everything they asked me I had in the background. The chemistry department prepared me. And they were amazed that you could come from Slippery Rock. And again, you know, it goes back to what Bob said. They're using the same books as Harvard. And these are people who teach. They're in the classroom. They're not sitting in a lab doing their research. They're interfacing, interacting with students. And so he says, our students can handle themselves. And I think we're seeing that. We've got some good students out there who are doing some great things out there today. They maybe aren't presidents of countries or presidents of corporations, but you only can have so many chiefs.
We had an amazing number of 2-0, 2-1, 2-2, 2-3 students who came out of communication who are now just excelling out there in that real world. So their 4 years was beer parties and social activities and not heavy on the books, but they were people who didn't lose their motivation once they got.
Well, I think got part over of their that, vacation. I think part of that can be attributed again to the faculty who take some of these kids under wing. And when I say faculty, I don't mean that just in the classroom sense, but I mean that's the people in the department, the staff, the clerical, all those kinds of people. And there's an awful lot of that going on. I never realized it as much as I do now today because of the international students, where a secretary will call and, you know, want to know about this kid and say, we want to do this for the for the student. And I think that's happening not just with international, it's happening with the American kids too. So it is kind of a unique little goofy place in the middle of nowhere in western Pennsylvania.
Yeah. What kinds of, you paint such a rosy picture, what kinds of things were disappointing? Was there anything over the years that shouldn't have happened?
Yeah, I think a lot of it, we went through a real, I think, a rotten time when Autrell was released, and then that interim period, and then when we went to the outside and brought in a president, Herb Reinhart. I think that was a very disruptive period for us because the word we was rarely ever used. It was only I. And I don't think there was really much care for Slippery Rock at that time. It was what Slippery Rock could do to enhance my resume, my portfolio. I think those were very devastating times. The negativism that was here, I think everybody felt on edge. You didn't know who you could interact with, who you could trust, because you didn't know how it was going to get back up to third floor. And those were not enjoyable times. I don't know if I would still be coaching if he were not here, or were not been here. But it was one of the major things that made me want to leave was him. And it was to a point where it was no longer fun, and I saw that not only, you know, in the departments and faculty on campus, there was a childish mentality,
a serious morale problem.
Yeah, it was demoralizing.
Yeah, very demoralizing. Yeah. I think that was our real down year.
I thought Larry Park did a really good job of healing.
Just
in 2 years.
Kind of letting the dust kind of settle.
I loved his first speech to the faculty. You know, he said, "Do not regale me with any Albert Wattrell stories." He said, "I'm not here to hear those stories." He said, "I know the stories." He said, "Just don't do that." Anyhow, that I remember that from his speech. I got some notes from that speech somewhere. It was a lovely. It was a very, very fine, honest, straightforward. You know, he wouldn't allow himself to be called acting president. You know,
that's right.
Yeah, he sees that that isn't the way it's going to be.
Well, too bad we couldn't keep him instead.
Yeah, I thought of what happened. The transition was. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was a downtime.
We did some good stuff.
Thing that I never will forget, and I think we all ended up getting caught up in it too. You didn't dare do a thing without covering your backside, and so if you ever looked on memos or things that went across campus, I think one time I counted 10 carbon copies to 10 different people. Everybody was running scared. You carboned everything. What a difference today, because I will get things back from third floor scribbled on my memo that I sent up. Whereas before, boy, you had to have a formal memo back and 10 people copied. Yeah, I mean, everybody was apprehensive instead of, and that takes away from creativity. You can't be creative when you're constantly looking.
You didn't sign a memo all by yourself. You got about 10 other folks.
So they couldn't figure out who did it. And that was a disgustful 2 years or whatever long it was.
Oh boy.
Make no bones about it. Yeah. I think we are now also getting to some points where we're losing some of our diversity here. On one hand, we're working so hard to be culturally diverse in what we're doing with the international students. But because of the restraints that have been placed on us by the state, we've had to eliminate those out of state. And if you stop and think about it, that's also tremendous diversity. what's wrong with having the kid from New York City here? They're going to add something to this very provincial little locale. That's cosmopolitan. But as you know, we've lost our out-of-state students. Tremendous drop, and I think that's not healthy.
And that's being duplicated by state after state.
Oh, yes.
Those out-of-state tuitions.
And they're coming in bread. That's not a good sign.
They've gone crazy with that in the Carolinas and just kind of everywhere. And it's just it was universally a very bad thing to have happen.
Yeah. It really
what
is.
What they should have done was just drop those barriers entirely.
Make it reciprocal.
Let it flow, because that adds to the diversity, and I see that we're going to become very close-minded, because we only have one frame of reference. That's this local Western, and that's, you know, nothing wrong with it, but it only happens to be a very little part of the world and not the world.
We need to find out about those people from West Virginia. That's all there is to it.
I don't. Jeez, Joe.
Well, we already know about folks.
We bought that farm.
Yeah.
What about the relationship with other athletic endeavors?
There was great camaraderie when we were coaching. I don't know if it's there today. And I think that one will take some time to heal, but it will heal. And maybe heal isn't the word I'm looking for, but when we were coaching, men's sports dominated. Our women's sports were something just thrown off to the side, and what was left, that was there. And obviously, I think in any human endeavor, when the haves have to give up, there's resentment. And so, you know, there's that. I think it's starting to become a part of the culture, the way of thinking that, you know, I have a wife and I have a daughter in high school. She deserves every opportunity as our son had to participate. But you know, when I was coaching, it was, what do you mean? We should get everything. I mean, but that's the way it was, and that is changing. And I think that has caused some of the athletic problems. We're into this gender equity now. I hear the coaches talking about that. I'm glad I'm not involved in all of that, the new Supreme Court guidelines and all of that kind of thing. And so, you know, that takes time to work. That takes time to work through. It really does. So I don't know if that one will be resolved overnight, because as I said, the haves never like to give up for the have-nots. That's human nature. I don't care if it's in a political arena or an athletic arena or in any relationship. But that's I think another problem that not only this campus faces. Maybe we face it in a little differently, or maybe a little more so than other campuses, because we have such a large athletic program compared to other schools. And we have had traditionally, you know, a large, because of the outgrowth of the physical education program. But I see that as, I hear that. I'm glad I only hear it.
I saw a TV bit about an athletic director at a high school in New England. And along with her on the TV was a young woman who was on a football team, mm-hmm. and a young man who was on the hockey team, which was traditionally a girl's.
Oh, the field hockey, yes.
Field hockey, the field hockey team. Both students were very comfortable with their role, mm-hmm. and so was the athletic director. Since you're no longer really occupied with that field anymore, what's your prediction for that kind of integration? Is that just a dream?
I guess if you look at it in theory, it should be, and it shouldn't make any difference, but we had a soccer game, our daughter had a soccer game last Thursday, and it was the first time in which they had their game, and it was going to be followed by the boys' team at the high school. And on the girls' team, there are some very talented young women for soccer. The first 2 years here locally, they had to play on the boys' team because there was no girls' team. It's only been last year and this year. And then the boys' team came out after the completion of the girls' game, and those very talented young ladies could not have played. The game is so different. And so what I see is the value is in certain sports, in order for them to compete, you know, it's, I'm glad there's a separate team for our daughter.
They're not strong enough, is that?
Yeah, strong enough, fast enough. I mean, it was just an incredibly different game. The speed of the game is so much different. But that's in soccer. Mm-hmm. That isn't, you know, in the other sports, I wouldn't be a bit surprised. Obviously, look at what's happening in track and field. Not in the sprints, but in some of the other sports, the times for women have dropped far more dramatically than times for men. Mm-hmm. Simply because women are getting a chance to participate in practice and have great training and follow those regimentations. And probably there will come a day in some areas where there'll be very little difference. And so what? So big deal. So if they can, you know, let them go together. I see nothing on it. But
let evolution handle it.
Let evolution handle it.
Yeah, yeah.
We do it in every other thing.
In the courts.
Let people evolve it to where they feel comfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw that a young lady just kicked 6 extra points and does the field goals. And
I think actually it's going to help athletics in this respect. I think we started to see where athletics begin to decline because of so many other interests in society today that students have. But now, when you have so many women and so many young girls participating, there's something to keep both groups there instead of going off into this multitude of activities that's out there in society today. And we're seeing greater numbers, I think, starting to participate. It's holding kids because I like to be around the girls. Girls like to be around the boys. They have something in common they can discuss. Their performance, their team. So, no, everything takes time. But
yeah, our first state championship that came out of our high school was the girls' basketball.
Uh-huh.
And finally, the guys won a state championship in football. But we were second. We weren't first.
Yeah.
Just went to a high school football game in my hometown for alumni weekend. 7,000 people at that football game.
Mm-hmm.
7,000. These are little teeny towns, Stanley. This isn't Wheeling and Parkersburg. This is Middleburg and so forth. That's an incredible turnout. But that's what they do in the small areas. They follow their athletic teams, girls and boys.
Oh, athletics are still great. There's nothing. If they're kept in a proper perspective.
Well, I think they are. It isn't like when I was a kid, the guys who played college ball, some of them, came and played for the high school team on Friday night.
Oh, no, that's
played college
those
ball.
Days are old.
Oh, yes, right.
Boy, you are old, right. Joe.
Yes,
I don't want to say
night.
That. But
didn't mean to bring that up.
We didn't get back to your really early life. We started you when you came to Slippery Rock. Tell us something about that background.
Well, as I said, I happened to be at the University of Buffalo with Klinger and Rod Oberlin, and they said that somebody had moved on from Slippery Rock to, I think, Boston College or Boston University, and there was a position open. And they said, why don't you drive down and interview? They called Coach and came down and spent time with Coach and then the then dean, Bill Mizey. Drove back to Buffalo, and my wife and I had been living in Michigan, teaching and coaching. And I said, guess what? We got a job. First time I'd ever done that without consulting her, anything like that. And I said, we have a job. She said, where? I said, in Slippery Rock. And so here we are. Came here with the intention of leaving. Seriously, did come. Figured, chance to get into college coaching and then moving on through that kind of lifestyle until went to a convention, coaches convention, and happened to be standing around a lobby and listening to two coaches talk. Never forget it, the guy was 49 years old, just lost his fifth job,
they just got fired, the whole staff got fired. Their daughter in college, two children following, and no job. We found home.
And we're not going to be out there at 45 or 6
I'm
or whatever.
I'm not going to chase that rainbow.
Yeah.
I'm not going to chase that rainbow. And yeah, I said, this is, it's the same football. It's the same field. It's the same equipment, except there's not 100,000 people. And I said, you know, we got security here.
Joe Paterno had Penn State tied up.
And Joe Paterno had Penn State tied up. So, but no, and so that's how it came to stay, and begin to see that this is not a bad place to live. We've got the amenities of Pittsburgh, and then when this job that I'm now in came up, can go away from home, can travel, but yet still come home. It's been ideal. It's been ideal. Yeah, the people have been, it was a very social campus when we first came. Very, very social, as you know, the parties that we used to have.
Oh my goodness, yes.
The football staff always had a party. Somebody had a party. Doesn't mean that I think that we were, you know, wild party goers, but it also gave us a chance as coaches to meet the faculty and to develop a real good camaraderie, drink a few beers.
Yeah. Those were wonderful years.
Yes, they really were.
They kind of slipped away from us.
Maybe George is trying to bring that back. George has parties. George invites faculty to all his games, and he's trying to do that same thing again. But I think there's a different thing. George has it very much more difficult than what Bob had, in that when you came and I came, there was a tremendous growth. That was that growth period at Slippery Rock. And we're all very young people. You know, we're getting old now and setting our ways and, you know, that kind of stuff. So there isn't that, I think, you know, there's that whole era is kind of passed. But then when they get rid of you and I, or as they got rid of you and are going to get rid of me pretty soon, Joe, then maybe that whole new group will come in and they'll do those same things over again, huh?
Young, energetic ones.
Young, energetic.
Okay. Gee, I hope so. I hope they have as much fun as we do.
Did you, you had a football career in college?
Oh, yeah.
And in high school?
Uh-huh.
And where was that?
Central Michigan. I lived in Michigan all my life until we came here to Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Never left Michigan, and taught and coached in Michigan for 5 years before we came, and just, you know, as I said, happened to be in the right place at the right time, and was ready to move. I said, no, we're not ready to move.
So football was a big part of your
early life. It was my life. I would not have gone to college.
You went on scholarship?
No. Mm-hmm. No, but I just enjoyed it, mm-hmm. And it was football that kept me studying, believe it or not, because you had to maintain your eligibility, if it wasn't for football, I doubt very much if I would have gone on to school.
I was a referee in West Virginia, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. when I was a long time ago, the early 50s, late 40s. And I would go to the coaches' conferences at Jackson's Mill,
uh-huh.
in West Virginia. And it was really a great fraternity of gentlemen. Mm-hmm. Those guys liked each other. They respected each other. Mm-hmm. They played hard against each other. And somebody won and somebody lost and somebody got a better job and somebody didn't, you know. But it was quite a fraternity.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect still is, that whole...
Oh, yeah. I think that, too, is maybe to some degree is changing simply because, you know, a lot of the coaches today in the high school level are not teachers. And that's sad. Because there aren't teaching positions, and people are only coached so long. I mean, you do get burned out. That's a rare that there are the Joe Paternos. Those are the rare, rare birds that can go for 35 years or something like that.
Sure.
And...
And then there aren't the teaching jobs to open up, and so many of the coaches today are working out in the community and just come in and to coach. That's right. And
cars.
That's right. And just coach. And so therefore that camaraderie isn't there because they don't have the time to interact. And I think that affects the students. And, you know, we have part-time coaches here at the university who really just come in part-time to coach and leave. They're great coaches. But I think that's all of that thing is missing.
How often do you see some of your former athletes? I know Dennis is around and Tommy, the lineman. Tom Yatsik.
Sure.
And but those guys drop by from time to time.
Oh, they sure do.
Yeah.
Oh, sure they do. Yeah, they come up. They have events. In fact, a couple of them want to initiate a 20 years celebration next year. Those championships.
Yeah, the 74.
Yeah. They won a couple of them were up for homecoming and talked to coach about doing that. So, yeah, they stick together. And George is working with a lot of them in fundraising. And they're the ones now who are out there in positions to support. And they're remembering Slippery Rock and they're helping.
Yeah, with IUP's enrollment and so forth, do they have an unfair advantage against us?
Yeah, I don't. Enrollment means nothing. You still have to have 11. It's the support that IUP currently has at this time.
From alumni? And
I don't know where their funds are being generated, but they have, what did George tell me just last week? They have the equivalent of something like 32 full scholarships. They can break it up any way they want, but they have an equivalent of 32. And I think George works on about 16.
And the reason we don't have that is simply money.
Pure money.
Funding.
Funding.
There are no constraints on IUP in terms of the number. There are some.
They're NCAA constraints.
They're within limitations.
And they're within the NCAA constraints. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that does. That has an effect.
So if our alumni support or whatever support is legal, we're greater, then we could be doing a little better job with our
recruiting.
Or,
sure.
Yeah, sure.
Oh, sure.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
That's true of AAA.
Oh, or, any
yeah,
level.
All levels. Yeah.
Yep. All levels. Yep.
Yeah. It's called tradition. And money.
Yep. In athletics, that's still a big word.
So you've had a lot of really good years and high points.
And low points.
Yeah.
Still can't tell you the score because I have selective forgetting, but the low point of getting all the hype at the University of Michigan and then just getting ourselves waxed.
Oh, my goodness.
Embarrassed, not waxed.
52
embarrassed.
To 7.
I don't even bring
some
that up.
Horrible,
so I'm trying to forget that. But, yeah, those kind of low points were.
That's a big audience.
Yeah, those kinds of things. Yeah. And, yeah. Those things you never forget. If you mess up somewhere along the line and give the wrong question on a test, you can correct it. But when 50,000 people saw you make a fool of yourself, that one sticks with you.
But it doesn't hurt so much all these years later, does it?
Ah, really?
Things that balance it out.
Well, oh, sure it does, but
that's
almost sticks in there. Yeah, it really does. Because you took such pride, you should have been the one who won, and you allowed yourself to be beaten.
Shippensburg, of all people.
Yep.
That doesn't make sense.
So every loss, you know, takes its toll. Doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. I really can't remember many of those great games that you won. I really can't. I didn't particularly like games anyway. I was kind of a different coach. I enjoyed during the week preparing my group to beat you. That was the challenge. The game was almost anticlimactic. Some coaches love Saturday. That's what they live for. I lived for practice because I was going to beat you on the game. I was going to beat you on the practice field. Our kids were going to be prepared that whatever you did, they were just going to automatically respond to it. We were going to teach them. And I didn't. I was never one who could make profound changes in 5 minutes on the sideline or in 10 minutes at halftime. We had to do our homework. We had to. Yeah.
If it hadn't happened by Saturday.
Yeah. And so the games to me were anticlimactic, except the losses. You know, you played every game to win, and then when you lost, that sticks.
So with all those mini games you played, the big wins.
I can't even tell you the scores of those championship games. I can't even tell you the scores.
But the losses.
I can tell you those losses. Because we did something wrong in our preparation that we should have done, that we didn't do. Yeah, but that was my approach to the game. Mike Parasol, who was here, was fantastic on Saturday. I mean, he could make changes and do things that were incredible on the spur of the moment. And he lived for that Saturday to do that. I just wanted to get the game over and hope it went in the W column. And I wanted to get back to work on Sunday so that we could start tearing you apart and dissecting you, the next week's opponent, to be prepared to let it just roll, let it function the way it's supposed to function.
What happens when there are 12 guys on the field? I never did quite figure that out.
Well, that means coaches can't count.
Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
My pleasure.
Enjoy that.
I will.
It was good.